All right, next case, 11-647, Disciplinary Counsel versus Edward Bunstein. Okay, Mr. Bunstein.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I want to first start out by explaining to the court how I got involved in this case. I received a phone call from an individual by the name of Natalie Creed. I had known Natalie Creed. She was upset. She was crying. She indicated to me that a representative of the Ross County Sheriff's Department had been up to her house and discussed with her husband, identified as Russell Creed, an incident that occurred at the residence of Ed and Bonnie DeLong. I knew Ed and Bonnie DeLong. I knew Bonnie DeLong well. I had represented her in some legal proceedings. I knew of Ed DeLong. I had prosecuted Ed DeLong for domestic violence, with the victim being Bonnie DeLong. I had done, although I had no open file with Bonnie DeLong, at the time of this incident, she was going through a dissolution. I was not counsel of record for her on that, because there was only one counsel of record that I had addressed that issue with her as well. I indicated to Natalie Creed that since I knew Bonnie DeLong and I knew of Ed DeLong, that I would contact them and inquire about the situation. I did that because Natalie Creed was a friend. The following day, I called Ed and Bonnie DeLong, asked them if I could discuss the incident with them. They indicated yes and invited me out to their home. When I got to their home, it was clear at that particular point in time that both Bonnie and Ed DeLong had changed their story or changed their opinion about the incident involving Russell Creed.
Counsel, what was your intent here? What were you trying to do at that point?
My only intent in going out there was to find out what had happened. I had no knowledge.
Why? Why was it any of your concern at this point?
Well, because Natalie Creed had called me.
Because you're an attorney.
She called me probably because I was an attorney. I would say yes. I was a friend
as well. And did the DeLongs know that you were an attorney?
Yes.
Okay.
It was clear that when I got out there that both Ed and Bonnie DeLong had changed their opinion. They indicated to me that they felt that Russell Creed hadn't done anything wrong. They felt that they were too hasty in coming to their original conclusion. They indicated to me that they had no intention of testifying and that they wouldn't testify.
At that point, why didn't you just say you need to contact the detective that's investigating this case?
Well, I can get to that if you would let me proceed.
All right.
When I ended up speaking to the DeLongs, there was no question that in my mind what was occurring between the DeLongs and Russell Creed was that they were sharing prescription pills. And I think that's supported by not only the facts, but the statements that were made, as well as the timeline. And the timeline starts by Ed DeLong looking at his pill bottle and determining that in his opinion, he had less pills than what he was supposed to have.
Mr. Bunstein, I don't want to interrupt your presentation, but you've got 15 minutes and you're using a lot of it. We realize that at some point you've entered a plea of no contest and were found guilty of a misdemeanor offense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
As a result of this activity that you've been describing to us.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then disciplinary counsel began to investigate as a result of that. And what we're called on here is to make some analysis about what happened in your situation and what an appropriate sanction should be. You recognize, I think, that your conduct violated the code, do you not?
I do not.
You do not. What was the nature of the no contest and finding of guilty for disorderly conduct? Doesn't that violate the code?
That no contest plea, in my opinion, would violate the code.
Well, the finding of guilty would.
That's not what I was, that's not what the complaint that was filed against me pertained to.
Well,
what I would like to share with you is this. If you look at...
You were trying to help two people that you thought were in bad trouble, and you didn't get it straightened out the right way, and one of them gave you $1,000 in cash, and it just got carried away. And but the bottom line is, when we look at the conduct that you got involved in, I mean, the panel recommended a public reprimand, didn't they?
They did.
And you don't agree to a public reprimand. Am I getting this right, or I want to understand what you're arguing to us.
Well, what has happened is that through this process, and this has been going on for 4 years, when I spoke to both Ed and Bonnie DeLong, and they shared with me what happened. And the facts were that Russell Creed brought out some pills. What had happened was Ed thought that he was missing some pills. He asked his wife, "Did you take my pills?" "No." "We'll call Russell Creed and ask him if he took my pills." Bonnie DeLong calls Russell Creed and says, "Did you take any pills?" "Yes." "Okay, you need to bring them back." Instead of calling the sheriff, it was bring them back. That's what Russell Creed did. Ed DeLong and Russell Creed got into an argument. "You didn't bring me back."
It really isn't about them. It's about you drafting an agreement and having them sign it in an effort to avoid criminal prosecution, isn't it? And then you tried to retrieve the contract.
Well, not...
And that's the behavior that we're looking at, because we want lawyers who represent individuals not try to accommodate things and not try to frustrate investigations.
Your Honor, I agree with you. But what happened when I got involved in this case was, when I was out at the DeLong resident, they shared with me a piece of information that this court needs to know. And the information that they shared with me came from Natalie Creed. And Natalie Creed was out there with her husband the second time. And I asked Bonnie DeLong, I said, "Well, did Natalie Creed say anything?" "Yes, she did, Ed." "Well, what did she say?" Bonnie DeLong then tells me that approximately 6 months prior to this incident, Natalie Creed had called the DeLongs and asked them to stop giving prescription pills to Russell Creed because he was becoming a drug-dependent person. Bonnie DeLong tells me additionally that on the night of the incident, that issue was brought up again by Natalie Creed. The sharing of medication is one thing, but I would cite to the court Revised Code 29-2502, and it reads in pertinent part, "No person shall knowingly do any of the following. Subsection 3 says, by any means furnish to another a controlled substance and thereby cause the other person to become drug dependent. Hydrocodone is a Schedule II drug. A violation of 292502 is a second degree felony, and the statute of limitations is 6 years. I couldn't bring this up until now, and there's a reason for it. Bonnie DeLong died May 21, 2011. What was I going to do? Say to the prosecutor, to law enforcement, hey, look, here was where I was at in regards to this case. I spoke to Ed and Bonnie DeLong, and I told them that, frankly, I wasn't concerned with the sharing of the medication. There's no statute in Ohio that prohibits the sharing of prescription medication. But there is a statute in regards to what I've just talked about. And I told Ed and Bonnie DeLong that I was concerned about charges being filed against them. So I agreed to prepare these voluntary statements. But I agreed to prepare these voluntary statements on certain conditions. And those conditions were that, number one, they weren't going to be released to anybody without their consent. Number two, if they wanted them destroyed, I would have destroyed them at their request. And number three, I had authorization to destroy them in the event I felt that at any time they were in jeopardy.
Okay, what was the purpose of these statements?
The purpose of the statements was that I intended to go to the sheriff's department.
The voluntary statements specifically state that the respondent was to take the statements to the sheriff's office.
That's true.
Okay.
And that was what my intent was. But the usage of those voluntary statements would be dependent upon what the sheriff and I talked about. If the sheriff wanted to listen,
were you representing somebody at that point?
No, I wasn't. That's just it. I was not representing anybody.
You weren't representing Bonnie DeLong in a divorce action at all?
No.
Never did?
No. It was a dissolution, and there was only one counsel of record.
And that wasn't you?
Was
you never counseled her on that?
Pardon me?
You never counseled her on that.
I spoke to her about her disillusion, yes. But I wasn't her counsel of record. But when I looked at this case and I elected to prepare, draft those voluntary statements, I still believe that those statements were protected under attorney-client privilege.
How could they be attorney-client privilege when you just said you weren't representing any of them?
Well, because I believed that I could prepare those statements on behalf, and once I did prepare those statements on behalf of Bonnie and Ed DeLong, then there was a client-attorney relationship established by implication.
Do you still believe that?
I do, Your Honor. And if I'm wrong on that, then I'm happy to take responsibility for it. But when I prepare any type of papers for anybody to sign, I have always taken the approach that that's a document that I can't release to anybody without their consent. I believe that.
And but was it Mr. Creed that gave you the $1,000 or the DeLongs?
No. What happened on it was is that, and this happened, Your Honor, this happened within a 48-hour time frame. Mr. Creed learned shortly thereafter that I became the focus of an investigation. And the reason was is because when I went, I had told the DeLongs the next day, they had signed the statements. I told them to read it. I told them not to sign it if they weren't true. And I told them that the next day I was going to go over and talk to the sheriff's department. What happened in this case is Ed DeLong went in before I did and told the deputy sheriff that his statement that I prepared was entirely a pack of lies.
Counsel, in retrospect, would you have done anything differently?
Sure.
And what would that be?
I wouldn't have gotten involved in it. It got, what happened to me, Your Honor, was when I learned what Natalie Creed had said to the DeLongs 6 months before and the night of the incident, that was a problem. I could have walked away, probably should have walked away. At the same time, I thought I had people that wanted to tell the truth, and Bonnie did throughout these proceedings. She's the only one that testified at my disciplinary hearing, and she testified that the statements that she signed, the statements that Ed signed.
You have let the prosecutor sort that out if it came to criminal charges instead of doing what you did? If you had to do it over again?
Certainly. I mean, what it's done to me as an attorney, I'm not the same person.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hissom?
Heather Hissom on behalf of Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. The board encapsulated this entire matter in its report when it found that respondent engaged in a pattern of conduct designed to protect himself from criminal prosecution and to conceal facts regarding his earlier role in obtaining voluntary statements from Ed and Bonnie DeLong. This finding sums up why the violations and the sanction in this matter are appropriate. The board properly found that respondent committed violations of the Code of Professional Responsibility and recommended a 6-month suspension with no time stayed. What this case is really about is an attorney who inserted himself into the middle of a criminal investigation, obtained voluntary statements, which are sworn affidavits from the victims of a crime, and then, when respondent's own conduct became the focus of a criminal investigation, began to maneuver to protect himself. Respondent was acting as a self-appointed community helper without any regard for his ethical obligations as an attorney. Although the panel did not find a violation of 8.4C, the board did. And in its report, the board lists one of the factors in its decision to reinstate that charge, and that is respondent's offers to destroy evidence.
Is that the most grievous charge that you find in this scenario, Ms. Hissom?
The board found violations of 8.4 C, D, and H. Of those three, C is the most important.
And those were the statements that were delivered that the respondent was attempting to get back to destroy, the voluntary statements that he had prepared.
That is correct. That's the one instance to support that charge that the board states in its report. However, if you review the record, there are many other instances that support that charge. As stated today, he did not have a client, but claimed attorney-client privilege at times.
When he prepared those statements for them, did an implied attorney-client privilege attach?
Bonnie DeLong at the hearing testified that she did not consider the respondent to be her attorney.
Regardless of whether they considered it or not, we have a lot of case law that says you even go visit somebody, you have an ethical duty then, because an attorney-client privilege is attached to, like, advise of a statute of limitations even if you don't take the case. So how does that law interplay with his drawing statements that they're, you know, that they at that point attested to him were true, and then maintaining that, telling them, I will destroy them if we don't use them as part of that relationship? How does that, is there an implied attorney-client privilege?
I think there probably is, in that when he was out at their house, he did give them some legal advice. He did prepare the statements, and he did take them to the sheriff's department on the DeLong's behalf.
And if you're representing somebody and you go to a prosecutor's office, you have no obligation to turn anything over for somebody you represent unless you go through a formal legal process of discovery, correct?
That would be true, but at the point that he gave his interview at the sheriff's office, the respondent was actually the focus of the investigation at that point, and the voluntary statements were the evidence of the potential criminal action that was then being investigated against respondent. And the DeLongs did give their consent to have those voluntary statements released to the detective who was investigating that.
And were they released once he did that?
They were released once. Well, there is some factor in that. The respondent refused to release them. The DeLongs were called by the detective, and then the statements were released
so
by the respondent.
He wanted to be sure that the DeLongs had agreed to their release before he released them. How is that a violation?
Well, there are a couple of things involved in that also. The voluntary statements on their face state that is the intention of the DeLongs to have them released to the sheriff's office. So on the very statement themselves, it says that it is our intention to have them taken to the sheriff's office and given to the detective who is investigating the criminal case with Creed.
That doesn't determine whether an attorney turns something over when they're working with somebody. That's something between the two of them as to what their future course of action is going to be. And when they turn it over, then it's evidence that they intended to. I mean, I don't see that as being determinative. And the fact is they were eventually released, so I don't see where the issue is.
They were eventually released, but the issues are not just in not turning over the voluntary statements when asked. They are in the creation of the voluntary statements and then what happens after they are given to the police. The respondent makes multiple statements wherein he is inconsistent about what his intention was, who he represented, and what was going on in this situation.
So is the violation making out the statements, or is it the respondent's statements about why he made the statements?
It's a combination of everything. If we're looking at the 8.4C violation, which contains the deceit and the misrepresentation, a lot of that is dependent upon what happens after he releases the voluntary statements. And the statements that he continues to make about who he represented and did he give certain people advice and what was his intention with those. There's also the 8.4D and H, which is fitness to practice and prejudicial to the administration of justice. Some of that has to do with the creation of the voluntary statements. He inserted himself into that underlying criminal investigation by going out and talking to the DeLongs. And if the DeLongs had said, we don't really want to see anything bad happen to Russell Creed, we've thought about it, instead of preparing these statements that contain some harmful information to the DeLongs, what he could have done is just said, why don't you just call the detective tomorrow and have them come out and tell them, you know, you've reconsidered, you don't want to testify. That's something for the detective and the prosecutor to determine where their charges rest at that point.
Counsel, what about the $1,000 to Mr. Creed that apparently was kept for 8 months? What was the testimony regarding that?
The testimony regarding that was that the voluntary statements and the phone call and the visit to the sheriff's office happened in September of 2007. The testimony in the record is that sometime at end of September 2007, maybe October 2007, Russell Creed came to the respondent's office with $1,000 cash and attempted to give it to the respondent. Respondent has testified that at first he didn't want to take it, but he did. He did not place it in an IOLTA or a bank account. It sat $1,000 cash in his desk drawer until Russell Creed gave a statement to the prosecutors and admitted that he had given the respondent $1,000. That was in May of 2008.
Did he say why that money was given? Was it because he was acting as his attorney or?
There is nothing in the record as to specifically why it was given. The only thing that is in the record is respondent's testimony, which is that Russell Creed gave it to him because the respondent was now the focus of a criminal investigation.
So, counsel, the focus on the respondent occurred because the DeLongs went to the sheriff's office after they filled out this statement, after the respondent visited them, after that all transpired. They go to the sheriff's office the next day, is that it?
That is correct.
And says, wait a second, we got to clear up some things because it's all unraveling here. you know, this attorney came to see us last night and we filled out this statement and, you know, let's just clear the air. Is that what we're to understand?
It was Ed DeLong who specifically contacted the Sheriff's Department on the morning of September the 20th, which is the day after they signed the voluntary statements, and made statements that he felt pressured into signing the voluntary statement and believed that some of the information in it was not correct.
So he implicates the respondent as being, at this point, obstructing the investigation and creating a document that contains information that's false.
Correct.
And that same documents had incriminating evidence that Bonnie had signed,
that
correct?
That is correct.
So that's when the sheriff says, well, we might have another problem here. Let's take a look at this attorney and see what he's doing to kind of gum up the works here as far as our investigation between the activity of the DeLongs and the Creeds.
That is correct.
Okay. And at that point, you say the respondent starts an evasive course of responses to questions and also representations. To make a long story short, he pleads guilt, pleads no contest to a misdemeanor charge as a result of this interaction with the Creeds and the DeLongs.
That is correct.
Okay. And then a continued course of misrepresentations and less than truthful responses to the disciplinary council in that investigation before the panel, correct?
I'm sorry, I guess I don't understand the question.
Was the your allegation here is that the respondent misrepresented and activities of deceit during the investigation by the disciplinary council and the case that was presented to the panel?
No, I think I mean the investigation into his course of conduct in the criminal case.
What about his response, cooperation level, and participation and representations to the panel at that hearing?
To the panel at the hearing, he was confusing at best, I would say. Not really forthright in giving testimony. It was a very long hearing with the respondent to get correct and straightforward answers from him. But the panel did not, in its report, find that he was not truthful with them. But they did find that he acted with a selfish motive and failed to understand the consequences of his actions.
So this panel that heard him through this lengthy testimony, heard his explanation, found a public reprimand, and the board went higher based on reinstating a claim that the panel had dismissed?
That is correct. It is respondent's own testimony, his varied recorded statements, and his writings that caused the board to find aggravating factors of a dishonest and selfish motive, and his failure to accept the wrongfulness of his conduct, which actually has persisted even until today.
Did Bonnie Long ever retract her statement?
Which specific, her, but the voluntary statement that she signed?
Two voluntary statements, one signed by him and one signed by her. He went and said, mine's not true. What did she do? Did she ever rescind hers or say hers wasn't true?
The police officer who testified and investigated this action testified at the hearing that he did go out to the house and did speak with both Bonnie and Ed DeLong before he interviewed the respondent.
But did he testify that she retracted her statement as well?
And he came to the conclusion that there were problems with the voluntary statement.
That there was what?
That there were problems with the obtaining of the voluntary statement.
That was statement. My question. My question was, did she ever say, I also lied in my statement?
There's no direct testimony on that at the record, and the underlying police records were excluded from being admitted at the hearing, so there's no documentation in the record as to her actual statements to the detective. Lastly, the sanction in this matter is appropriate. Respondent was found to have violated Professional Conduct Rule 8.4 C, D, and H, and in accordance with this court's prior cases, an actual suspension is appropriate. This court has held that significant mitigating factors, can warrant a departure from an actual suspension. And in this case, the board found two mitigating factors. They found no prior discipline and other sanction, being respondent's no contest plea to the misdemeanor charge. There was no other mitigation presented by the respondent. These two mitigating factors are not enough to overcome the presumption of an actual suspension in this case, and the six-month suspension recommended by the board is appropriate. Thank you.
Counsel, you've used all of your time. You may have 30 seconds to sum up.
I disagree with opposing counsel. Bonnie DeLong, to my knowledge, never changed her story. In fact, she signed an affidavit, I think it was Exhibit 3, and then she signed a second affidavit that was prepared by a different attorney stating that everything that she had attested to and signed was absolutely accurate. I would further indicate that in reference to this $1,000, when Russell Creed came into my office, the reason he put it on my desk was he felt bad about the situation. That's why he did it. I never represented Russell Creed. The incident.
Counsel, do you understand that you create these statements, you have Mrs. DeLong and Mr. DeLong sign statements that truly are against their interest? They are admitting in those statements activity that can be viewed as criminal. And you have them sign those statements as a friend?
No.
Okay, just let me finish. Then those statements, well, the DeLongs, maybe the light bulb went on and they said, what did we do? You know, we put something in writing that's going to get us in trouble at the advice of our friend slash attorney. And then you couple that thinking that those statements are in some way going to help the Creeds, and then Mr. Creed comes in and gives you $1,000 and says, you know, thanks. Do you see how, taken in totality, your activities are viewed as in violation of the Code of Professional Conduct?
Yes. At the same time, Russell Creed came in, I handed back to him the envelope that he had given me. I didn't even look in the envelope. He came back in my office, dropped it on my desk, and said, if you don't want it, throw it in the trash can. That is the statement on that.
And in 8 months or so, you couldn't have found a way to give the $1,000 back even to Mrs. Creed?
At that particular point in time, I didn't want to have any contact with Russell Creed or Natalie Creed because there was an ongoing investigation, and they asked me not to.
Who's they?
Prosecutor. Additionally,
did you tell the prosecutor, by the way, I've got $1,000 in an envelope in my desk drawer. What should I do with that, Mr. Prosecutor?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Because I felt that if I told the prosecutor that, he would say, see, I told you, you were representing Russell Creed. That's why I didn't. If once they asked me about it, I told them that I had it, and I kept it in my office where it was. One of the things that bothers me is, at any time, what did I conceal? What was I obligated to give to the prosecutor? If I should have told the prosecutor about the $1,000, and that's what this court believes that I should have done, so be it. I take responsibility for that. But at that particular point in time, I was under investigation, and I wasn't going to speak to the prosecutor.
Were you represented by counsel in your criminal investigation?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?
Yes.